Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Maiden, who's director of the China Energy Programme at the OIS. And today we're going to talk about China in 2020 and 2021. You know, what were the takeaways of 2020? In fact, a year was tumultuous in the world. And also try to answer the questions as to what does this really mean in 2021. Michael, great to have you here.
It's great to be here, David. A happy new year, a bit belatedly.
yes. You know, that's such a good point you've raised. Just let everybody know, we are recording this on the 15th of January, when we're in a crazy situation of JKM Asian spot prices being at $32.50, UK NBP prices at $8.50, and Henry Hub at $2.60, and Brent at $56 a barrel. I think we have to say that, Michael, don't we? Because it's changing so much so quickly.
It is indeed. And the world around us is changing every day as well.
Well, let's start. You know, that's a good question. Where do we start after such a year? You know, what were your takeaways on China in 2020? So why don't we start with the COVID situation?
I think, you know, when we look at it now in hindsight, of course, all we can say, and we're not going to go into the origins of COVID, is that China managed the pandemic rather efficiently. When we again look at the end of the year, we can go back to the podcast that we recorded, sort of first half of 2020, where it was huge uncertainty. Today, the Chinese economy has stabilized. It has recovered quite phenomenally. And actually, it's also managed to sort of reestablish its centrality in global manufacturing as sort of other countries are still mired by lockdowns. China is back up and running. It's probably the only or one of the only major countries that will actually record positive GDP growth in 2020.
Well, it's interesting because I just wonder, you know, did China set the stage for building back better?
It's a very good question. And if you look at sort of the what has happened in the short term versus the medium term, you're going to get two very, very different answers, right? We've seen oil and gas demand were both very strong last year. They recovered strongly. Imports were off the charts. Electricity demand, especially in the fourth quarter, was huge. There were sort of increases of 10% year on year in electricity demand. And everything that we've seen sort of from the actual recovery was very fossil fuel intensive. A lot of coal, a lot of sort of smokestack industries, infrastructure building, real estate. And yet when you think about the long-term plans and sort of the stimulus package that we talked about quite a bit that lays the foundations for rapid electrification of the Chinese economy, that does point to a greener horizon sometime in the future. And of course, in September, we had Xi Jinping announcing that China would peak its emissions by 2030. That's not very new, but that it would aim to be carbon neutral by 2060, which was, of course, earth-shattering in terms of the climate ambition. And so it's really a tale of two, more than halves, but the reality, which is, again, fossil fuel heavy, and the long-term plans, which are quite climate ambitious.
It's interesting because I think, and I know we'll talk about the winter in a minute, but of course, people were not expecting that recovery, were they? You know, and, you know, the whole carbon neutrality pledge, you know, has been born out of industrial policies. I just wonder, you know, whether people were actually expecting what actually materialized.
No, I think the carbon neutrality pledge was a huge surprise, not just for observers outside of China, but also within China. Because again, we did see, you know, local governments favoring incumbents, which are fossil fuel heavy. And we were scratching our heads a little bit trying to unpack this carbon neutrality pledge. We did publish a paper on this in December last year. Where did it come from? I mean, the Chinese leadership has not been oblivious to the risks associated with climate change. So what happened now to bring about this very ambitious pledge? Again, especially in the context, and again, you discussed this with Philip Andrews Speed, how the recovery was looking very brown. And so I think really what has changed is the recognition that China's industrial complex and its economy is no longer fit for purpose in a carbon conscious world. I mean, there's a business opportunity in Build Back Better, but also with the EU Green Deal and the EU recovery focusing and potentially including carbon tariffs and carbon taxes, China could lose out if it doesn't rejig its supply chains more fundamentally.
Do you think that the COVID-19 pandemic, I know we're not going to go into any details of kind of where it came from, all that, but do you think that was in any way a catalyst to drive this change in mentality on carbon neutrality in any way?
I think in hindsight, we will look at this again as a turning point. Again, I'll refer you back to Philip's paper and podcast on this. I think when we look back at it, and not for the reasons we think, again, I think it is because of industrial policy, and it's COVID plus US-China tensions, or this assessment in China that its external environment is deteriorating, that its role in international supply chains is now threatened. And that has meant that China has to rethink both its energy supply structures and, again, more fundamentally, its economic sustainability for the future.
Okay, well, look, let's move on and talk about government policy. You know, what has been the thinking during 2020, and how did it change as the year progressed?
And obviously, after we got over the initial rush to tackle the pandemic and to get the economy back on track, in terms of energy and I think more broadly, the sense was, again, this focus on the deteriorating external environment and security. And then energy security in a very broad definition. We tend to think about supply security as limiting import dependence, and that's obviously part of it. But I think COVID really highlighted the lack of resilience and flexibility in the energy system. And so that means diversification of supply sources, but also of suppliers. And that's, you know, dovetails with a longstanding theme of liberalization of the energy market, letting non-state actors come into the system. And that creates needs, again, for more flexible pricing mechanisms, for better price discovery. All of those things, I think, were really highlighted to the leadership. But of course, reliability, stability in supplies were sort of the big headlines. And I think those elements will carry on into the 14th five-year plan.
It's interesting because when I talk to people in the wider energy world, there's a general perception that actually the energy markets worked and the prices have reacted to supply demand. But of course, within China, which is so reliant on imports of energy, it's so interesting, isn't it, that security supply actually has gone up the agenda. When a year ago, if we'd had this podcast recording, it wouldn't really have been there, would it?
It was already starting to emerge, I think, on sort of US-China tensions and concerns, again, about import dependency and the prices of imports. But I agree with you, and I think what in Q4... 2020, when we actually wrote a paper on kind of supply security, one of the biggest threats was US sanctions. US sanctions on Chinese shippers, and the US's predominance in financial markets. And obviously today we've got the news as well that the US is sanctioning CNOOC, the third largest oil and gas producer and importer in China. So I think these are still very valid. Where COVID came in was on the flexibility and resilience of supplies. It was actually managing the downturn in demand, where, for example, again, we had LNG and declarations of force majeure, again, something that we discussed with Agnieszka in a podcast earlier in 2020. It's how to manage both the upside and the downside.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we must mention, of course, we are a week away from a new US president. And so we have to wait and see how it's going to play out. But we won't necessarily address that in this podcast. But I think we are going to talk about the 14th year plan in a minute. But it's going to be interesting, isn't it, to see the extent to which the 2060 carbon neutrality pledge actually forms in that plan, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's a huge expectation that the 14th five-year plan is sort of a bellwether of China's climate ambitions and whether the 2060 plan will be reflected in it, the 2060 pledge will be reflected in it. I doubt that we will fully see the climate ambition in this plan, in part because this announcement, the September pledge, came out of nowhere for the Chinese bureaucracy as well. So they're scrambling to translate this into reality. And I think we will see some elements. We'll talk about that a bit later in the 14th five-year plan. But it might be premature to use that as kind of the test, the litmus test for China's ambition, for China's climate ambition.
Well, before we look forward to 2021, I would just like to focus, if I may, for a few minutes on the winter, because certainly, you know, the winter of 2020-2021 and also, you know, China's demand response, and also it's had a huge impact not only on China, but of course on the global energy market. And at the beginning of this podcast, I set out the prices where we are today, you know. So perhaps you can kind of give us your view. You know, what happened in China?
It was a very interesting combination of strong economic recovery, strong demand, and policy quirks. I mean, I think, you know, we tend to view China as this huge monolith that is capable of long-term planning, which it is, but it is not capable of planning down to the week and the month. And actually, sometimes the plans do backfire. So what we got, you know, it started off with power cuts and power rationing throughout, well, not throughout the country, but in a number of provinces in the country. And again, that was because economic activity rebounded well more than a number of provinces had anticipated. But for some, it was shortages of coal supplies, both on the domestic side, because there have been limited investments in unprofitable coal mines. The Australian coal import ban had a small part of that. I mean, Australian coal imports are 3% of total consumption. It didn't help, but that was not the main driver. But in Zhejiang province, actually the biggest cause for power rationalization was that they hadn't met their 13th five-year plan targets of reducing coal capacity and reducing energy intensity. So they just shut down power. And there was the same story in 2010, when again, they hadn't reached their energy efficiency targets and they had to shut down. So this is clearly one of the kind of quirks of policies, of these kind of very rigid policy goals. In other provinces, part of the shortages were actually related to lack of interregional electricity trading. So, you know, China has, this comes to a wider debate of China has excess capacity for power, and yet it doesn't have enough peaking capacity for some of the winter shortages or the summer spikes. But will that then lead to a greater reliance on coal? Because again, coal is reliable and coal is stable. I think that will be.
Well, of course, if you want peak shaving capacity, you've got to pay for it. So there's got to be somebody holding that capacity. But you mentioned, you know, earlier on about the gas shortages, which specifically, and I'm quite interested in. And also, you know, there, of course, they've just set up this new midstream company, Pipe China. You know, so is there an issue there as to who's responsible for supply security in the country for gas?
Absolutely. The gas shortages were, again, sort of supply-demand balances to a certain degree, because, again, with industry, and industry is the biggest consumer of gas in China, right? I think a lot of people assume that the power shortages then had knock-on effects on gas. But actually, gas in power generation is 3% of total power generation. We do think there will be more gas in power. Again, we published an excellent paper in late December on the prospects for gas in the power system in China. But it really was misplanning and sort of mismanaging the winter, because the majors had said that they have enough in storage, and storage has actually been full earlier this year than in previous years because demand was relatively weak. But then with Pipe China, which is a fantastic move forward, it's a midstream company that's an operator and is supposed to grant third-party access. There's been this hot potato issue ever since October between the majors and Pipe China of who is actually in charge of guaranteeing supplies. And with the pricing mechanisms and the regulatory framework still sort of half-baked, we came to this winter crunch and nobody's willing to foot the bill of higher LNG imports. Sort of the majors have been holding on to their gas and not necessarily shipping it, or so Pipe China claims. And now they're not willing to pay for expensive LNG, but people are left out in the cold. So again, I think over time, these things will be ironed out. But in the short term, there are all these kind of quirks and the changes in market dynamics that are having ramifications on international markets. But I think they will be short-lived.
But it's interesting, Mikhail, isn't it? Is it the responsibility of central planning? Is it responsibility of local planning? Or do you use the market with flexibility of pricing signals and other kind of market directions? Not to mention, you know, storage as well, you know. Which way do you think China's going to head? Is it going to head towards more policy direction, or is it going to head more towards market signals?
Both is the horrible answer, because it's extremely contradictory and it's very hard to figure out. But that has been in all the policy documents. You get talk about market playing a greater role in resource allocation under the firm and guiding hand of the government. So it's this constant adjustment. I suspect that after this winter, we'll have another adjustment. But will it mean more market prices, or will it mean more central planning? We will have to wait for the kind of takeaways, for the official sort of post-mortem on these winter shortages to see which way we will go. But I think going forward, we are going to get a bit of both. That is the, I guess, the beauty for analysts of China, but the challenge for markets.
which is great, which gives us lots to evaluate and study in the OIES China program. But anyway, well, look, come on, let's now move on to the million-dollar question, which our listeners are really wanting to hear. What does this all mean for 2021, Mikhail?
I think if we look at the kind of macroeconomic or the bigger picture, 2021, and the consensus, I think, is it's going to be another very strong year for China, certainly in terms of GDP growth, be that because of a low base last year, but also the economic momentum that has already been picking up will continue. As the world recovers, there will be a further uptick. Now, I think there's another interesting question on sort of do supply chains start to move out of China now that other countries are back up and running, or has actually China continue to cement its role and its centrality to supply chains, but really another strong year and quite a bullish outlook, I think.
And okay, so that's policy, that's economy. For our listeners, who I think they really want to know, what does that mean in energy terms?
In energy terms, it's another strong year, again, not just because of economic momentum, but because of the policy side. For oil and gas, the liberalization agenda continues, and you have new buyers to the market that are being given access to markets. For LNG, as long as LNG prices calm down a little bit and go back to sort of lower spot levels. But it's interesting, will this now make decision makers say, actually, we want to go back to oil indexed contracts, right? Last year, they were saying, ooh, maybe we need to get to rely on spot markets. But now they're seeing the kind of downside of spot markets. And so they might actually want to go back to oil indexed contracts. But it's certainly a strong year on liberalization, on new buyers, on new infrastructure. I mean, in terms of refineries, there are two large refining plants coming online. And storage mandate, I mean, we're looking at another million barrels a day of incremental oil demand, crude demand for China at least. LNG similar, there are sort of LNG import terminals that were delayed last year that are starting this year. It's almost 20 million tons per annum of new capacity that could be starting just this year. So really a very strong year on, again, new infrastructure and liberalization.
Okay, so you're pretty bullish. But I'm wondering, you know, as an LNG guy, you know, how is this going to play out between the balance of LNG, pipeline gas and domestic production and supply within the kind of the China market? How's that balance going to work out?
There is going to be an attempt to balance it out. I mean, we're looking at over 30 BCM of incremental gas demand from China this year. Half of that is LNG. And again, it's a very bullish story for gas markets. It could be higher, but I think it won't be. One reason is the power of Siberia has reached almost its sort of intended capacity. It was supposed to reach 5 BCM this year. It's probably close to it. And now there's talk of doubling it to 10 BCM in 2021. And again, the mandate for domestic production continues to grow. And not only that, I think when the majors look at kind of their domestic market, they're seeing pipe China that is encroaching on the midstream. They're seeing the independents that are starting to encroach on the downstream, which leaves them to focus on the upstream. And really gas is, I think even gas at the expense of oil production will be what they focus on going forward. So yes, it's bullish for LNG, but the supply security dimension will be something of a limited factor on growth. But again, for I'm sure gas markets will be happy to get a 14 BCM increment from China.
Oh, I think they'll be very happy with that. But and it actually might underpin new FIDs, which is, of course, we've been talking about in the Institute and indeed in the industry as to how we can get new FIDs for gas and LNG production in this market. So I think it's a lot to watch in 2021 on that. But one of the things we talked about earlier on, two things actually, talked about the 14th five-year plan. And also we talked about the need for additional storage, gas storage within China. So perhaps you could tell us what we're likely to see in the 14th five-year plan. And also, you know, are we going to see new storage additions?
I mean, for gas, it's been critical because China's storage capacity is just a fraction of entire demand. And that has been one of the challenges with flexibility, not just this winter, but last year, again, both on the upside when demand increases and when demand falls. But here, the regulatory framework is really challenging. There are no incentives for gas buyers to store. There is a mandate for commercial companies and cities and townships to have forward cover, but they've not been really filling that mandate, again, because there are limited incentives to do so. So I mean, we've reached, there was a target in the 13th five-year plan to have, I think it's 14-15 BCM of underground gas storage capacity, and that has been met. And we will probably get another target like that in the upcoming five-year plan. But it's really the operational stock, so to speak, and the import terminal storage that will need to be beefed up. Now, for some of the import terminals that are under pipe China, they can accelerate that addition. I think import terminals in general will want to increase storage capacity for operational purposes. But that, I think, is really going to be a huge focus for policymakers. And I think it will give a little bit of upside to the market. For oil markets, of course, storage has been the biggest question. And, you know, we wrote a paper with the oil program on the missing barrels and tried to assess how much of that has gone into oil storage in China. I think that, again, offers some incremental barrels going into China in 2021 again next year.
But fundamentally, within the five-year plan, you know, do you expect to see the liberalization move continue? And I think the other key thing is, you know, should we expect carbon neutrality, the carbon neutrality pledge, I mean, to be front and centre of that plan?
I think the liberalisation issue will continue to figure in the plan along with market reforms. But again, we have to be careful how we interpret that. It doesn't mean full privatisation of the Chinese energy industry, far from it. It means enabling non-state actors to have a bigger share of the market and to challenge the state-owned majors to become more effective and more competitive. The idea, again, is not to dismantle the state-owned companies. They are very, very important in the system, and I think they will remain so. And again, we'll get these. There was a white paper that was issued on energy in December 2020 that talks, again, about decisive role of markets and the guiding role of the state. So we're going to see a push for liberalization and market reforms, and these long-standing contradictions remain. Now, as for the carbon neutrality pledge, I think it will be front and center in the areas where China can win, can sort of benefit from it. So things like technology, things like more renewables in the system, I think those will certainly be in the 14th five-year plan. But I think the leadership still needs time to tackle the losers and what to do and how to help fossil fuels adapt to this new reality.
Okay, so Mikael, you know, could we perhaps, for our listeners, kind of give them some indications, some of the issues, some of the traffic lights they should be watching out for in 2021?
So I think we can look at them in sort of two separate buckets. One is on the policy side, looking at kind of the 14th five-year plan framework and how provinces break that down, and then specifically on the energy mix.
Okay, so why don't we start, therefore, by looking at the policy issues?
I think we also have to bear in mind the 14th five-year plan, it will come out in March. And that will be an overarching plan, and more detailed plans will emerge thereafter. We also need to be looking out for a 2035 vision. The government is working on a 15-year plan. It wants to double the size of the economy again in the next 15 years, with a focus, of course, on efficiency and quality. But the message there is growth. We still have growth, and we still have energy consumption. There's going to be a huge focus on technology, so we need to look out at which industries are getting the most funding. Hydrogen will be up there, CCUS potentially, but a lot of energy demand side management technologies. So we need to look out for not just the big five-year plan, but also the Ministry of Science and Technology and the Ministry of Industry and what kind of targets they come up with. And then provinces. Some provinces are going to be extremely ambitious. Guangdong, Shanghai, they're probably going to issue, again, very ambitious targets. But whatever they issue will also be telling how much the central government is urging them to be climate conscious. And so it's not just what they say, it's how they say it. Sort of, have they gotten their marching orders? Have they already heard that the central government is focusing on climate? Or are their marching orders growth?
It's interesting, of course, we have actually during 2020 in many of our podcasts talked about the importance of innovation and technology in the China plan. OK, but let's kind of conclude this podcast of now looking at some of the key issues in the energy mix. So what are the areas do you think our listeners should be looking out for?
So obviously we look out for the specific targets for energy, sort of for a breakdown of the energy mix. Having said that, those targets can be a bit misleading. In the 13th five-year plan, we had initially a target for gas to account for 10% of the energy mix. That was revised down to 8% later, and that has now been met. The upstream production targets were not met. the shale production targets were not met. So maybe this time we get slightly vaguer goals or goals that run through 2030. I think when we're looking at the carbon neutrality pledge, we need to look at coal. Is there a coal cap? So does the government say this is the amount of capacity and we're not adding any? Is there a carbon emissions cap, an absolute target for carbon emissions? And is that in the power sector? Is that economy wide? And finally, do we get any indications on nuclear? I mean, we haven't spoken too much about nuclear, but when we think about the world of renewables, of a system that relies on renewables and the intermittency issues, it still needs a lot of baseload capacity. Now, is CCS a viable option for Chinese fossil fuels? It's unclear. And so to what extent are decision makers thinking about nuclear now as a viable option, and do they start to take action in this five-year plan? But of course, I think renewables, we're going to see a huge boost in renewables. We also have to bear in mind, though, that the plan is slightly tactical, that leaders don't, or they will be loath to issue targets that they cannot meet. So again, something that is not overly aggressive doesn't mean lack of ambition.
And of course, all these energy-related issues are ones that we will be following in the OIS China program, and indeed other research in the Institute, won't it be, Mikhail?
100%. Absolutely. That's going to keep us extremely busy over the coming year and years.
And we will report that not only in our reports, but also I hope we'll be able to do that in our podcasts and our webinars as well. Look, Mikhail, you know, thank you so much for your time. You know, as always, I really enjoyed our conversation on China's 2020 reflections and the 2021 opportunities. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.